Just a few minutes after 7 o'clock last night, I remembered that on the evening before, as I flew by airplane into Birmingham, I had seen a stunning view of the moon rising over the city. It was full, so I thought to myself, I should try to see this again. So I Googled, of course. You all remember about Googling, right? And the moonrise, 7:44. But where would I find a high spot? So many valleys and ridges run through this city. Well, what about the Vulcan? Is there an observation point, I wondered? Yes, you know it. I hope you've been up there. I grabbed my bag, I jumped in the car, and I drove less than 10 minutes from right here. Parked and paid my $4.40, and then I had to go back to my car because I forgot my phone. And then I booked it up the hill. After I showed the man my ticket, I opted for the steps. Happy for a little more exercise, and I didn't really look at my time on my watch, I just climbed. I knew it would be close. Just as I topped the final flight of stairs and came out onto the viewing deck, the moon was just coming over the horizon. And you know how it works on the horizon. It was refracted, so it was very large, orange, glowing, just peeking up over the trees in the east. There was a couple who was about to get on the elevator and go down. And I said aloud as I came out onto the deck, whew, just in time, there it is. The city lights were there to the north, more lights to the south, but right there in that space where there are very few lights, rising up. The woman said, "What is that?" "It's the moon. Isn't it gorgeous?" "Really? It's the moon?" she said. "I'm not making this up." "Really? You should get outside more often." I didn't say that. I just thought it. I quickly forgot that couple, who just as quickly went on the elevator and went on down. I was wishing for my good camera, my telephoto lens. Instead, I turned on Facebook Live, and I offered the world a tiny little reminder that the moon still rises in the east, and they might consider getting outside, too. After about 3 minutes, I turned that off, and I just soaked in the larger moment. I breathed it all in, the moon, the city, the cool air, my front row seat on the glory of God's creation. For the heavens were declaring the glory of God. The firmament was proclaiming God's handiwork. And no amount of picture taking or social media sharing can capture that beauty, that stunning vision, that experience of being there. Yet when I tell you this story, something probably rises up in you, some other story, some other moment, maybe another moonrise, maybe an impromptu adventure that you took recently, or climbing those stairs up the Vulcan. Perhaps you remembered some other front row seat you've had on the glory of God's creation. Every day, we are offered a front row seat on the glory of God. We're invited to behold. Instead, we often sit in our seats, we fidget, we go for a soft drink, we let our minds wander, we reach for our phones, we're distracted by a million thoughts and feelings. or we try to capture and consume, like I did, that moment of glory to suit our own needs and desires. But the glory of God can't be consumed or be mastered, captured in words, just to entertain us or make us more attractive. Yet remember, as we spoke about it 2 weeks ago, there are millions and billions of dollars generated every year by exploiting these very deep human needs and desires. We talked that first week when we were together about the four horsemen, and for those of you who weren't here, I'll remind you who they are. They're running away with our lives right now. Amazon appeals to our gut, our need to consume, and it fills that need so fast and so easy and with free shipping. With each purchase, we're convinced that more stuff will, as the psalmist said it, revive our soul. Apple shapes our desires to be more attractive, to have the finer things, to light up the night. And as the psalmist said, to enlighten our eyes. Google knows all. Just ask. And it stands ready with answers, the most trusted search engine and storehouse of knowledge anywhere in the world today. Google seems to know more than God. It's all at your fingertips, and the promise is that even the most simple person can sound wise when they ask Google, and that wisdom is simply for everyone. Fourth, the Facebook. Facebook stands in for our relationships. It puts our feelings into tiny little emoticons, emotion icons, and promises to make, as the psalmist said, our hearts rejoice. How do we push past these gods with their deceptions and their distractions? I used every one of them yesterday, preparing this sermon, climbing that mountain. They're with us all the time. They're inescapable parts of our lives. And they, along with many lesser gods, demand our attention and pull us away from our front row seat on the glory of God. For help on this matter, I want us to turn again to a friend, only a friend through writing her a couple of emails. She's not a dear friend, but someone who's become a friend through her writing. A solitary, Maggie Ross. In her essay, Practical Adoration, she offers up silence as a tool of interpretation and analysis. Silence is very dear to me, and it has become a way, with Maggie Ross's help and the help of others, that we might interpret and find deeper understanding of the very text that's before us today. In fact, Ross helps us frame the work of silence with these questions. Hear them. She says, what does this text, experience, or person tell me about the vision of God? How does this text, experience, or person encourage me to enter the silence of adoration more deeply? Will this text, experience, or person create an inner storm of pleasurable excitement or anguish and distress, clouding the mind with noisy distraction? And this is the key summary question, I think, that she asks. What is the quality of silence in this text, this experience, this person? When we look intently at any of the four horsemen and behold what they have to offer, asking what is the quality of silence in this experience, we see each of them dissolve almost at once. In fact, they promise so much on the surface and yet are so manipulative and all-consuming that we can sense the need to guard ourselves against them, all the while knowing we can never fully escape them. And because we behold them and they dissolve, we're left with the question of how we enter into a deeper silence. So I went in search of some help with that question. I thought of a book that might really help me and so fit with the text today. Sue Monk Kidd wrote the book, The Secret Life of Bees, in 2001. I read it nearly after the time, just after it came out. And I thought surely it would take us on the journey from the sermon today right up to the communion table, dripping with wisdom and honey, I thought. I even found a bread baker in the congregation. Mary Helen baked bread that looks like the honeycomb. That's okay. Enjoy that today. And I adore the writing of Sue Monk Kidd. Early in my life, she really opened up so much for me, shook loose further my captivity to the male images of God that have a hold on our culture still. And her journey, as she told it in another book, The Dance of the Dissident Daughter, really resonated with me. In fact, she helps reimagine the language of worship and helps us do away with all the images that dehumanize. But that was Kidd's first book. In The Secret Life of Bees, we find a real revolution in the fiction world. It was new. The religion of the women in the book center on a black Madonna, a figure of Mary pulled out of the ocean by slaves. And the central figures, characters in the book, are African-American sisters living in South Carolina in 1964. They run a bee farm. They bottle and sell honey. They are self-possessed. This week, I decided I would watch the movie to refresh myself. I had never seen the movie about the book. So I began the movie, and I realized I've changed a lot since I read that book. And I'm going to have to think about this movie with this question: what is the quality of silence in this movie? And what I found was a story of a white girl in search of redemption and her mother. This girl, whose name is Lily, how obvious could that be, was severely traumatized by her father and tortured by her guilt over the accidental death of her mother. None of this was especially surprising. In a way, this is Sue Monk Kidd's story and part of what I resonated then and now. But here's what's important. What dissolved under the scrutiny of the gaze of silence? And what dissolved was how flat, what became apparent was how flat the characters of the black women are. They were each given over to one stereotype of black womanhood. August was strong and loving. June was proud and self-righteous. May was emotional and crazed. And each woman's full experience was blighted under the blazing need of Lily's redemption. Now, in the movie, the actresses do a fine job of bringing this more to life in a full way. And yet, despite the fullness of the acting, the beautiful quotes from the book, the bees and the honey, I decided really to resist trying to make that our pathway to the glory of God. Because I don't want to keep alive an uncritical story of white women's need that oppresses black women and expects them to rescue us and prop us up. So the questions of silence that I brought to that text of the movie opened up deeper truth for me. And I needed to return again and ask of the psalm, how does that text encourage me, encourage all of us to enter into the silence of adoration more deeply? What the psalmist shows us is how to soak up each moment, to breathe it all in, whether it's the city or the moon, the sun, these people here in this place, this bread, this cup. Here, 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 we are all sitting on the front row of the glory of God. And what we share in this moment is presence, the full presence of God and each other, spilling over into everything if we will just pause in the silence and experience it, take it all in. So when we practice communion today, and it is a practice, we come each time learning it anew. Communion has a way of filling us that the consumption of Amazon cannot. Communion is the genuine path to reviving the soul. Communion shapes our desires in ways that Apple cannot. For Apple is just smoke and mirrors compared to communion, which truly enlightens our eyes to see the glory of God all around us. Communion is a practice of wisdom that cannot be captured, reduced, and sold by Google. Communion seems simple, just bread and a cup. Yet by taking it in fully and receiving it from that person right in front of us, we experience the presence of each other and of God. And in that presence is a wisdom that our very human being reflects the glory of God. Communion invites our hearts to rejoice in ways that can never be captured in a photo or posted on Facebook. In the receiving of communion, our relationships with God and with each other are manifest in a hidden wholeness. We are invited every day to take a front row seat on the glory of God. So as you come forward in communion today, I invite you to lean into that greater silence and hear through the words and look deeply into the eyes of the person who serves you. Because in that space, you will be sitting on the front row of the glory of God.